My name is Paulette Frankel. I'm an award-winning, best-selling author of two books, the most recent of which is Marcel and Me, a memoir of love, lust, and illusion about my 36-year affair with the great French mime Marcel Marceau. And my first book is titled Lust for Justice, The Radical Life and Law of J. Tony Serra. This is a very controversial book that has been on the bestseller list in its category for going on 5 years now. I will be speaking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By at UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, everyone. Hello, this is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am very excited and delighted to be talking to an authoress, also a mimess and a drawing-ess. Not sure if that is the correct grammatical word there, but it doesn't matter because I'm very delighted to be talking to Paulette Frankel. Not only is she known for writing two books, one of them about a lawyer who made a lot of trouble for other people and himself, and for probably the greatest mime of all time, Marcel Marceau. She wrote the Marceau book because she was his companion, his muse, his lover, and I do use that word advisedly, for 3.5 decades or so. Paulette Frankel is in the neighborhood with us, and we're excited to talk to her. Shalom, Paulette!
Shalom, Saul Solomon.
Now, there's a line in your book that did, I have to say, right off the bat, I've got to say this bothered me immensely. You said, quote, "My only brush with Judaism is a penchant for rye bread. Harumph! Harumph indeed! How come this is so, since you come from such a Jewish family?"
Well, actually, my family was not Jewish. The Frankel name is Jewish. And, you know, I think there are certain, I don't know, qualifications and to being truly Jewish, and I have none of them except the fact that somewhere along the line, it's definitely a Jewish name.
Well, wait a minute. So your father, who was an Art Deco furniture designer kind of person, he identified as what? Catholic, Christian, what?
He was raised Catholic.
Oh, and your mama was also?
Mother was a Southern Baptist, and then she became Catholic. And actually, because of the war and the whole issues of being Jewish during the Second World War, religion was never a part of my family or my upbringing. And I think it was sort of a survival mechanism.
So do you think somewhere along the way, one of them or their parents became Catholic because it was the thing they had to do, and that they were Jewish? Oh, yes, okay. So, somewhere in your lineage, there's a Jewishness. Are you? But you're,
I've got a Jewish nose, let's put it that way.
So do I, alas. So do I. And so did Marcel Marceau.
And, well, he was Jewish.
Yes, of course. Not only was he Jewish, I mean, I didn't want to get to this until much, much later, but he lost his father in Auschwitz.
He did indeed, and he saved many Jewish children, numerous Jewish children from the Gestapo, by teaching them the rudimentary qualities of theater and mime, the mime part being silence. And these were very young Jewish children who undoubtedly would have met their death had he not marched them out of France right under the noses of the Gestapo and into Switzerland, into the safety of Switzerland. And in his artwork, he often depicts himself as a leader of people out of the storm clouds of that aspect of Europe and into the multiple radiant suns of safety.
Now, wait a minute. You are talking about Marcel, not the dad, right?
No, I'm speaking of Marcel.
You are speaking of the son. Because the father, he got out and then he was put back in, right? He escaped for a bit and then they got him. What happened with that?
Well, my knowledge is the family was sent from Strasbourg, where they had the family home, and the father was a kosher butcher. And they were sent to Limoges, which was supposed to be safety, but instead the father was derailed, literally, and he was sent to Auschwitz while the rest of the family went south.
And then your father had a kind of a different thing, and much more success. He got out of Europe, came to America, did really well for a while in the Art Deco decorating furniture biz. But what happened?
What do you mean by what happened? You mean what happened from the doing well to life? Or
well, no, there was a thing where he died basically destitute, worried about money, in terrible shape. No? Am I wrong about this?
I'm pretty close. That's more or less, yeah, that is pretty much it. Well, one can say he outlived his success, which happens with a lot of people, and it kind of happened with Marcel as well. When people live to a ripe old age, the public no longer has interest in them. They've moved on to, I don't know, younger blood and fresher ideas and that type of thing. So my father's furniture was not selling, and he lost his health insurance and developed cancer, probably partially hereditary, but also partially from worries. You know, if you get yourself worried enough, all kinds of things go wrong with you.
Now, how close were you with your dad at this point? Because you were out there living a very exciting life, and we're certainly going to get to that. Were you around to see all this, or were you just phoning home a couple of times a year?
Well, I was at Stanford in my final years at Stanford, and at the time when he had cancer, and during the last part of his sickness, I dropped out. I took a whatever it is you take, so that I forget what it is, but you can get back in. And an incomplete in all my classes, and was at his with him at the hospital for the last couple of weeks of his life. So yes, I was there, and yes, I was also very much into my own life elsewhere. We had sort of parallel lives, as it happens with people who are very famous. You live under the same roof, but you're in different worlds.
Back when you were going to Stanford, what did you think you would do with your life? What did you want to be before everything else happened?
Well, I feel born to be an artist, and I've always had a penchant for writing, so I always journaled, even way back for as long as I can remember. But in those days, a woman was basically used meat unless she was married by age 22. If you weren't married by 22, you were rotting meat.
Wow.
And that, you know, that was...
Which is not kosher, by the way.
Excuse me?
Which is not kosher, by the way.
No, it's not kosher by any standards. So, whereas I certainly had a huge kind of ambitious streak in me, I also simultaneously felt that fame and that pursuit meant lack of family life and kind of equaled lack of love in the sense that there was no unity in the family.
What, did your mom and dad not get along?
Excuse me?
Your own mom and dad, how was their marriage?
Well, let me put it this way. It wasn't my role model of a marriage, but, you know, in many ways it was tight, and that was, my mother was the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. She did all the paperwork and all the numbers and bill paying and all the, literally the nuts and bolts, and my father was a creative one, and together they made a complete person. But all I saw was that my family was not like anybody else's family that I knew. And I wanted a dad who played sports and went camping and, you know, did sort of normal things. And I was too young and too sort of grass is always greener oriented to realize that the life that I was given was very extraordinary. There were geniuses in it. And so consequently, I have developed a taste for enjoying being around geniuses.
Oh, well, that's why you're on this program right now.
Here we are.
Rabbi Saul Solomon talking to Paulette Frankel. Now, there you are. You're coming out of Stanford. You're thinking about what to do with your life. And it's some, well, actually, before you turned on, tuned in, and dropped out, tell the story. I think it's kind of funny that the first time you saw a mime on the street, you reacted like most people react to mimes. Ugh.
Well, my very first encounter with mime actually was the film Les Enfants du Paradis, Children of Paradise, starring Jean-Louis Barrault. And it was a revelation for me that this dimension existed where someone could just kind of go into this realm of silence and depict everything that was going on in a way that was totally understandable. And then my next experience with mime was at the Renaissance fairs, plural, in California, where there were lots of mimes in the 70s. And then, of course, the name on everyone's lips is Marcel Marceau, who is the mecca of mime.
But it's funny, there was a, I thought I remember a little bit, an anecdote in your book, where you just saw a person, a mime on the street, and initially you were repulsed by him, but then he kept sort of engaging you and trying to make you laugh or engage with him.
Yes, that is true. I felt very, almost violated.
Wow.
As I was walking down the street with a friend, and suddenly this pesky mime wanted to engage in you know, the playfulness. And I didn't want the attention, and two, I hadn't invited it, and it seemed like he was trespassing my comfort zone. But then, since he wouldn't go away, I got into it, and it was a breakthrough for me, because I got out of my comfort zone, I went through my fear zone of being noticed in public and participating and kind of joining his language of silence, and at the end of it I was exhilarated by it. And later I became a mime.
You did? Now, did you study mime with Marcel Marceau, or you were already doing mime before you met him?
I was doing the street mime type of thing. So, no, I've never... Well, I had a little formal study of mime in Woodstock with a woman called, I believe, Maggie Green, who was really very good. And other than that, I've done everything... Everything that I've done best, I've really just done by the seat of my pants. And so I didn't study mime with Marcel, but I certainly studied Marcel. And I saw a lot of his performances, and I just looked at it like a starving person in the desert looks at a mirage of water. Just, you know, every wave of it, I just wanted to completely engulf and become.
Well,
consequently, I became pretty good.
Well, was he really better than any other mime, Etienne de Crew, whoever else? Or was it the combination of it? He was really, really great, and he just had great marketing and lucky and et cetera. But there were a dozen other people who were just as good, just not as famous.
No, I think he was indeed better. His level of perceptivity was uncanny. And his articulation was so crisp and so clean. And, of course, he'd been doing it since he was 4 or 5 years old. He literally was born to be a mime. And, you know, some people just are born to do what they do. And so they kind of have a huge running start on the rest of us who copy for a long time. Which is not to say that he didn't steal from others. He did. But it was his life, and I kept thinking that he was a normal person who did mime, but no, he was a mime who did normalcy. And these people, they really are different. That's all there is to it. They are a gift. It's a gift to be in their presence. They're very difficult to be around. Borderline impossible.
Oh.
At times, huge egomaniacs by our standards. By their standards, it's that this is their birthright. So, of course, they're the most interesting person they've ever met, and they're, of course, basically only interested in themselves.
For a moment, I thought you were describing me. But no, you were talking about Marcel Marceau, your friend, and eventually your love. Actually, we should say that really you, I don't want to say you threw it yourself at him, but boy, oh boy, when you met him once, it was almost by accident, and then you really, really wanted to meet him. You started writing him letters and these flowery prose things, and then he wrote you letters back. I mean, you were besotted with the man just from seeing him on stage.
I was completely cracked open. He touched me in places I had never been touched before, and it was extraordinary. And all I knew was, he was this incredible vortex. A lot of people who've seen him on stage have never forgotten him. He really rocked my boat, and I just felt I had to be closer to this energy, to this magic that he was exuding. So I just walked on stage while everybody else walked out of the theater. I just climbed on stage like I belonged there, like I was a stagehand or something, and I walked with the confidence of the naive and the stupid, and slammed right into him backstage in the wing. I couldn't see a damn thing. And bam, I almost knocked him over. It was horrific.
And he didn't really think that much of it at the time, but then you started the correspondence and trying to see him, and essentially setting up a quote-unquote romantic weekend for you to be together while he was on tour.
A week, not a week.
A full week. Was he,
yes.
Let's be honest here, was he married at that point?
What about it?
Was he married at that point?
No, he wasn't married at that time. He was between marriages.
Oh, okay, so that's... he was single. That's great. That's okay.
Okay, that works.
Well, it works for me. So, but people, and I'm going to say this, that people who get this book that Paulette Frankel wrote, Marcel and Me, a memoir of love, lust, and illusion, you're not just putting lust in there in the title to sell some books, although, of course, that will work, but you put some freaking lust in that book. My God, I mean, people will know a lot about this man.
And about me.
Well, yeah, this is true. This is true. Do you mind if I read a passage from this, just so people know what they're getting into here?
By all means.
Send the children out of the room, ladies and gentlemen. This is from... Oh, and I should preface this by saying... Now, you look at Marcel Marceau in film, and my friend Dave actually saw him on stage a couple of times, and it's all very, he is so fluid, and so delicate, and so gentle to watch him, and so precise. So you figure... This young, pretty girl who's going to go see him, they're going to have a romantic time for this week away in a nice hotel room, and he's going to be the most gentle, beautiful lover. Yeah, he's going to take, 7 hours for foreplay and 1 good minute for the final thing. But no, this is not what happened. Why don't you say what actually happened?
You want me to say?
Well, yeah, I have a passage to read, but it's before that. So why don't you say what he was like that first time after being such a gentleman?
Well, he was the equivalent of the wolf on Wall Street. I mean, we had had a lovely evening together. It was a little awkward for me because basically it was his closing night in Chicago, and there was a huge party afterwards. He had done a spectacular performance with, I believe it was a 20-minute standing ovation. And then there were parties. We went to these parties, and I felt like I was a stage prop. He was the king of Chicago, and everybody, of course, was swarming around him, and there I was in a completely absurd outfit that I had designed myself, a combination of what I could afford and what I thought was fanciful, and it was It was fanciful, but it was absolutely inappropriate for a high society party in Chicago.
And everybody was looking down on you, and you felt kind of, you know, weird, and you had to make believe that you were looking down on them just to get through the evening.
Just to get through the evening, I had to sort of pass and volley back the same disdain that they were giving me. And so then finally, endlessly, this evening just went on and on, and I had flown from California that very same day and was absolutely exhausted, and I was ready to just crash. I would kill for sleep, and so he took me to my beautiful hotel room, and we had the little French kiss on the cheek, and I thought, thank God, it's over, I'm going to sleep, and then he jumped me, just pounced, and I, between not really being able to grasp what was happening, which was completely obvious, my mind was spinning. I thought, my God, this can't be true. This cannot be my prince who has just become so carnal. And anyway, it's quite the chapter.
Oh, yeah.
And,
well, but was it, you know, when I was reading it, you wanted to be there. He was your idol, but it's borderline rapish. Yes?
It was borderline rapish, yes. And I was trying desperately to kind of go along with it. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I can't tell him to get the hell out of there. I traveled all the way across country to be with him.
Well, yeah, true, but still, no is... But you didn't quite say no, or whatever the French word for no is, I guess, no. But...
No, I didn't. I was grasping to catch up to his quick mind, and I thought, okay, if it's going to be like this, well then I'll get into it. But that wasn't what he wanted either. He wanted me to love him with my heart and soul, and I thought, oh my God, you're asking me to, you know, enjoy this horrible situation and make it be with my heart. And so I was completely out of my element.
And I think the funniest irony of this is that, you know, as things are getting more and more passionate, at least for him, well, you were starting to get into it, and then he's like, tell me how much you love me, tell me how great I am, you know, all these things that his ego needs to hear, and scream louder, of all things, for the most famous mime in the world. All he wants to do is hear you screaming.
Did you find it funny?
Well, come on, that's irony. That's the definition of irony.
It was the definition of irony. I mean, at one point, he was so electric. I mean, here's a man whose mere presence can illuminate an entire theater full of people. And here we are, body to body, and he was completely electric. And I felt like all my fuses were burning. I was being burned out. I didn't know where to concentrate. I didn't know where to put my focus. I was drowning and being turned on and turned off at the same time.
Well, let me read. This is a passage from your book, Marcel and Me, A Memoir of Love, Lust, and Illusion. Boy, check this out. His coat hit the floor along with the rest of his clothes. Being the quick change artist he was fully naked before I could even begin to grasp what was happening. Grasp being the operative term, I guess. I stood aghast, staring at his sturdy erect panpipe between his powerful furry legs. Wow! What an image! What the hell made you think about pan? Well, I guess certain things would make you think about panpipe. Wow! Did you take him?
Because he reminded me of Pan at that moment, obviously.
I see. Wow. Well, I guess his Peter was Pan at that point. And it was his way of showing that he was not an old man. Certainly not a woman, because he had effeminate gestures the rest of the time, or an old-world gentleman either, but rather lust personified. I can't believe you're saying this. I was pleased to discover that not all parts of his body were equally subject to the aging process. He was about 49 years old at this point. The family jewels seem to remain taut and forever young, immune from the ravages of time. I never really wanted to know what Marcel Marceau's balls were like, but there they are.
There they are. My editor thought he would be proud.
Oh, my God. Well, yes, because I'm telling you, I'm not that much older than he is, and mine hang down like an elephant. Oh, my God. You could sandpaper a porch with my nuts. I'm telling you.
But it was quite the experience, and that being the most horrific of our experiences together, then it goes to equal heights of truly divine. I mean, I've never experienced anything like him.
So did you taught him to maybe slow down, or did you just get more on his wavelength when he was an animal?
No, he was never animal again.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and he confessed at one point that for some reason, because people thought he was gay because he was so effeminate in some parts of his performances, and so in order to prove that there was nothing gay about him, homosexual about him, he went to the other extreme, which was to be violently macho.
Well, it's either that or the other extreme, I guess, is marrying Kris Jenner. But you know, just a little joke there. We're talking with, nothing. Just flatlining with that joke. Paulette Frankel here in the neighborhood talking to me, Rabbi Saul Solomon, about her love affair that wasn't just a week long with Marcel Marceau. Why, I have to admit, I haven't had time. I just got a copy of the book earlier today, so that I made it to page 10, and then I had to put the tissues and the Vaseline away. So why, I mean, you maintained some contact and relationship for decades, and yet you were never his official wife. Well, how come? What happened?
Well, after that particular tryst in Chicago and Detroit, which was a week long, I was hopelessly in love with him, and I could not imagine life without him. And as we parted, we were both crying, and he said, "I will call you." Now, prior to all this, he called all the time, so I thought, hooray, hooray, I'm going to get home. And I didn't want to leave at all, and had he asked, I probably would have just stayed forever and somehow arranged to have somebody, I don't know what, tie off the loose ends of my life at that time.
But
that wasn't what happened, and so I was fully prepared to direct the rest of my attention and my life to being his partner in one way or another. And then I didn't hear from him for over a month, in which time I freaked out every minute of every day. And it was just absolute agony, because we had really bonded. We had really taken this experience of togetherness to the absolute heights. And I thought, I felt like I had, that I was just a groupie who was being dumped, trashed like a paper cup, and he was on to the next. And, this is projection. The whole thing is projection. One can also say that love is projection. But anyway, the reason that I never became his missus, or even really took him in the same way again, ever again, was at one point he said, "Paulette, you must understand, the theater is my life, and it will never be any other way." And at that moment, I saw myself standing in endless lines while he entertained all the other people and women in his life. And I thought, this is not the life I want to lead. So there was a love between us, and I believe it was very genuine, and it went on for 36 years. And
But it was never physical again after that week?
No, it was physical, but not that way, not where I was completely open and just took him in with every cell in my body.
Wow.
It was kind of like normal or regular or unremarkable thereafter.
And you can wait for 37 years for him to come back, and you had boyfriends, you had, you know, people staying with you on this big orchard that you were living on?
I did have a life yes, and I did even have some lovers. They were sort of few and far between. But, you know, no one ever rang the bells like he did.
Gewalt. But wait, he rang, it was basically 1 week. I guess it was a magnificent week, but all your life has been kind of vortexed on a few times with that man on a single week.
Well, you know, I think in all relationships, I've had enough relationships now to know that in some ways things are completely right, and in other ways things are not right at all. Mm-hmm. And the one thing was, the theater was not my life, and I thought he'd be sort of like Chaplin, and we would, you know, we could have a life together after the show. But he wasn't like Chaplin. He was touring the world 300 days a year. He was a water bug. And I was basically, I don't know, I was grounded. I'm into gardens and plants and animals and children and all of that. Cooked dinner at night, that type of thing. He never ate before midnight, and always very light because he needed to keep his body weight exactly perfect, like a jockey almost. You know, if you're a pound over, it doesn't work.
Now, by the way, before you met him, you had the kid, right? You were married for a while?
Yes, I have one son.
Uncle, yes. What does he do, by the way?
Excuse me?
What does he do?
My son is a designer, as my father had been, but he doesn't design furniture. He designs the elements of gaming, as in Las Vegas. But at one time, when he was 18, he was considered the Michelangelo of America for his fine art. And he does have the family talent and is an extraordinary artist and sculptor. But because he has three children who are now all grown and needed to be sent to good schools and all the things that happen when you are family responsible, he opted to make money rather than follow his great talent.
Does he regret it, or you never ask him?
Well, I told him at the time that he had been given this incredible gift and that he must not trash it. And he said, "Mom, just leave me alone. I just want to be normal." So that's what he got.
Okay.
The gift is always there. I hope that at some point he will go back to it.
Now, do you still, I assume you still draw for pleasure, but you don't do the courtroom sketches that you were doing in your career anymore, do you?
Well, that was a career. I've always been an artist, and I'm looking forward to getting back to it. I put my hand to it maybe once or twice a year, which is, you know, precious little. But I do consider myself an artist, and I'm always sketching and keeping journals and writing, and I always keep one finger in it, on the pulse.
Well, would you say there's a difference, like if you go to street fairs and art shows and you get the people, you know, on 42nd Street or whatever, with the charcoals, and they'll draw you, they'll take 10 minutes, they'll sit you down and do a portrait. How is it different from what you do sitting there in a courtroom sketching?
Well, I think the main difference is, in a courtroom, courts can be, trials can be unbelievably boring, and there's not enough caffeine in the world. And then suddenly something happens, and if you are not totally alert and ready to go at that instant, and it only lasts for an instant, you miss the whole thing, and then it goes back to being boring again. So you have to really be on your toes, on, you know, have at the top of your game all the time, waiting for this moment to happen. And it's very brain enlivening. It's very taxing. Then you have to have camera ready art in an impossible length of time. And most courtroom artists don't eat, don't go to the bathroom, don't drink. They're just painting as fast as they can, drawing and painting, in order to have this camera ready art for the TV two time a day deadlines. And it's extremely exciting, boring, I don't know, and enlivening, deadening. It's the whole nine yards.
I'm curious, what is the reason, especially in this day and age, to use courtroom sketch artists instead of just taking a photograph?
Well, now they are doing it, and the courtroom artist is becoming, an endangered species. But at the time when I was doing it, I was just at the end of it. The cameras were coming into the courtroom, and the courtroom artists were no longer being employed. It used to be a very good job. You would be retained by the TV stations, and whether you worked or not, and when you did work, they just worked the hell out of you. It was exhausting. You'd go from courtroom to courtroom, sometimes two or three courtrooms a day.
Oh, wow.
It really was something. And you made a very good living at it, but those days are more or less over. I guess some courtroom artists are retained. Federal courts, to my knowledge, I haven't done it for a while now, federal courts still don't allow cameras in the courtroom. And Tony Serra, the subject of my first book, Lust for Justice, has a huge case coming up, and I will probably go to California and draw part of it to kind of complete the collection that I have done of my many years of following him and him alone around from courtroom to courtroom.
Now, when you say he has a huge case coming up, it's not against him. He is the lawyer in the case suing something, or you might as well tell us who Tony Serra is that you wrote your first book about.
Well, Tony Serra is a criminal defense lawyer, and his brother is Richard Serra, who is the world-renowned sculptor who shows he had a 40-year retrospective, and they completely restructured, I believe it was the Museum of Modern Art, just to hold his sculptures because they're so huge. They're huge metal pieces. And these two titans live at opposite ends of the country, and because of very deep arguments that they have with one another, they're not even on speaking terms. But they respect one another, and they're both at the top of their field.
Although the man you wrote about, the lawyer guy, Tony Serra, is he still choosing to live essentially not in poverty, but as if he were making a minimum wage?
Oh, he doesn't make it. I would say poverty is probably more like it. He is a complete eccentric, and he, like Marcel Marceau, I kept thinking, well, you know, he puts on this image, but he's just a normal guy who's pretending to be this, that, and the next. But no, he really is that way. And he just sent me a check for a little money for some books that were sold at a reading that he did of his own books. And he sends these things in, what are they called, cashier check things, because he literally does not have a bank account. He doesn't have savings. He drives old clunker cars. He dresses in court with clothes from the thrift. He has none of the trappings that one assumes a person in the law would have, and would be in the law for the, you know, partially because it's a very lucrative profession to be in. He shuns it all.
Wow.
And in fact has gone to a prison camp, I think 7 times, for refusing to pay income tax.
Oh boy.
And he did not lose his law license, but he does the time. And at one point, when they were about to send him away, and the media said, "Well, how do you feel about spending 10 months in prison with a bunch of prisoners?" This was prison camp, but nonetheless, they're all criminals. And he said, "I have more friends in prison than out. These are my people. I've spent my life representing them. They love me, and I love them."
Hmm.
It's a great book.
Wow. And what was the impetus of wanting to write his story? Was it just because he's such an outsider?
Well, I think the same reason for wanting to write Marcel's story. I feel very fortunate for having been able to get under the skin of these two extraordinary geniuses. And it was my tribute to them. I wanted to do them justice. I wanted to, you know, somehow give back. And so I wrote their story, and it was a hell of a job. The first book took me 17 years.
Oh, my God.
I was running away from Tony Serra as much as I was running towards him because he was making himself so impossible. And his vortex was so huge. I now live two states away. I have him to thank for that.
Were you, was there ever a relationship with him? Romantic of any kind, or?
No, not at all. We never even hugged.
Oh.
No, not at all, at all. But, you know, everything that is close and intimate and under the skin, as I call it, you have to love in order to do it. Otherwise, why bother?
Hmm.
And so, and certainly in writing a person's story. And I wanted, in both cases, with both Tony Serra and Marcel Marceau, I wanted to humanize these giants who people think are gods. And they are gods in their arena, but they're human beings, you know, after hours. And so what are they like as people? Do they send Christmas cards? Do they, you know, do they do anything normal at all? Or do they just sort of float around bigger than life? And they're very normal and suffer the same insecurities we all do. Marcel's insecurities were shocking.
Well, I mean, people might not know this. He was wearing a wig back in his 40s when you first even met him.
Yes, he was. I've never seen him without it.
Yeah.
And the damn thing would always kind of go crooked and, you know, it looked like a mop on his head. It was embarrassing.
Well, what else was unexpectedly kind of normal or irritating about Marcel Marceau?
Well, I mean, he did all the talking. Here's this person who, you know...
Irony again!
Whose signature is silence. He spoke many, many languages. French, German, Italian, Japanese. I don't know what all, probably some Hebrew. It seemed like he was multilinguistic. He was incredibly articulate. He was a fabulous storyteller, and of course he would mime everything. He was kind of like always on.
Even if you were the only other person in the room?
He didn't care.
Right. Hmm.
An audience of one was an audience. One hand clapping was a clap. You know, he needed that. He fed upon it. And at first I thought he was absolutely fascinating. Well, I always thought he was fascinating. But I also thought, what about me? When do I get to talk? And he didn't seem to have... I mean, he found... He could multitask. He could be on and do all of his antics and at the same time be looking right into me and reading me, like writing on a wall or something. And it was quite fascinating. So... Whereas I thought I would have to say something in order for him to know me. No, he knew me through and through. And I got very little to say. But we did have, conversations. And it took many years for us to get to that point.
Okay. Can I ask, I don't know if this is in the book or not, but when was the last time you saw him?
The last time I saw him, and I didn't put it in the book because it was better to end it with his 80th birthday in Los Angeles, his performance, where lines were going around the block. But actually, the last time I saw him was at a performance in Albuquerque, and I went with my granddaughter, and he was always very generous. And whereas he would allow no one to see him backstage, he would always allow me to come backstage. And so those became moments of, I don't know, you know, the intimacy as such. And when you're with these giant people with their giant energy, you cannot in any way compare it to normalcy because it isn't normalcy. So 10 minutes backstage would be like 6 months with somebody, else, you know, just the way it was. And we had, I don't know, 20 minutes or something backstage, and my granddaughter got to meet him, and That was very kind, and he apologized that he couldn't spend more time with us, but he said at this time in his life, his performances took every bit of energy he had, and indeed, he looked like one of those leaves after a performance where the moths have eaten out everything but the veins. I don't know if you've seen those kind of leaves, but he really looked totally spent. And so it was a great honor to be the only person that he allowed to have contact with backstage.
And did you have any correspondence or telephone? Did you ever talk with him again after that?
No,
wonderful...
we never spoke again, and I didn't really expect him to die ever. But because he had this uncanny, can't bust him quality about him, but I didn't know he was in terrible debt, and I'm sure that, you know, these things, that they eat at you, as it did with my father, and so...
Well, that, again, but you had mentioned that before, that it sort of parallels your father, that you get to a certain age, people don't want to see you. But all I remember, or at least I should say that the host of this radio program, Dave, remembers, is that even in his late 70s, he was playing on Broadway. How the hell was he in debt?
Because the audience wasn't that great. Huh. He was touring all the time. He never stopped touring, which, you know, that does take its toll on you, always to be going through airports.
Right.
And I think he was performing mostly in South America at that point. And,
But it was a one-man show. You need one helper, I guess, the person to hold up the cards. I mean, it's a simple show to light. Where did the money go? Did he live extravagantly?
I think there were about six people he was pushing around the world with him who did things for him.
Okay, still, I'm just, you know, that I don't understand.
And then he had four children and bunch of ex-wives. I don't know what sort of, you know, divorce settlements went along with that.
Oh boy. Okay.
So it all was, whatever he brought in funneled right out the other side.
Do you have your most precious keepsake of his, anything he gave you? Not just mental stuff,
actually,
but physical.
Actually, I do. And he gave me a lovely pendant that he had brought back from Bali, and it's a huge pearl, a sort of a half pearl, really. I'm sure it's, you know, one of these cultured pearl things, but nonetheless, and it's on a pendant, very nicely carved silver, set into a silver setting. And I treasure it. And, of course, the memories I treasure also. As I say, it was a love unlike anything I've ever known before, and it made me realize that so much of love is illusion, and we can manifest that, and we can experience the beauty and the exquisiteness and the other side, which is the agony of it. And at one point when I was going through the agony, I thought, well, if it's just an illusion, why don't I just, you know, pull up another illusion and suffer a whole lot less?
Wow. Well, as the phrase goes, you live, you learn. That's what it's all about.
You live, you learn. And to me, you know, since silence was his big thing and silence was our undoing because I couldn't stand it, he used it, I thought he was using it as a weapon when he wouldn't communicate. And but he said, no, silence is not separation, it's solidarity. And I'm still trying to learn the ins and outs of that. But I think maybe at some point I will know it. And his greatest strength was that he united the entire world through their understanding, their silent understanding of mutual emotion. He brought us back to our humanity. He returned us to our humanity. And how many people do that? You know, you can count on I don't know, two, three hands, how many people have done this in the world. And so, bravo, Marcel Marceau.
True. I mean, God knows I don't do anything towards helping humanity. Not a thing. I won't lift a pinky. But I do have marvelous guests to talk to on the Dave's Gone By radio program, and I want to thank so much Paulette Frankel. Please go to her website, marcelandme.com, to pick up a copy of her book, Marcel and Me, A Memoir of Love, Lust. Yes, there's a lot of lust in there, and illusion. Also, you want to get her other book. It's also got lust in the title. It's Lust for Justice. That's the one about Tony Serra, the lawyer. Is there another book on your horizon?
Not yet, but I have many more books in me.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Well, when you write the next one, please do come back in the neighborhood. We'll talk some more with the delightful Paulette Frankel. Thank you very much for sharing all of this with us in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Saul. You've been wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Shalom.
Shalom.